You guys are listening to TechEd TV podcasting series. In our show, we bring you the best in technologies, innovation, startups, fintech, artificial intelligence, cloud computing, and the latest and the greatest in technology worldwide. This show is brought to you by Igla Communications. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. You guys are watching TechEd TV with Dr. Edwin Hernandez. And today we have a new guest, a friend that we met a month ago, Ryan Nessing from, where are you based today, Ryan?
Well, I'm at home in my office, Austin, Texas.
Great. And you are Australian, is that right? Is that right?
Well, yes. I spent 10 years. I'm actually a dual citizen. I've got Australian citizenship and also American as of 6 months ago.
Congratulations.
I actually grew up South African. I have a bit of a mongrel mixed accent, grew up South African, lived there till I was 14, and then I spent the next 10 years in Sydney.
Okay. So you're familiar with Trevor Noah then?
Oh, yes, for sure.
Great. Yeah. So we have a very interesting conversation with Ryan because he's an expert in all kinds of stuff, especially in what it comes to investment. And he's an entrepreneur, CEO for several of his ventures, $300 million deals. And I can go on and on and on, but I would like Ryan to tell us more about his background a little bit. You went to college in Australia. So how is that different from the United States?
Yeah, you know, in the U.S., college seems to be like a very impactful period of someone's life, and which college you go to matters tremendously. In the U.S., sorry, that's in the U.S. In Australia, you know, college was not as big a deal. I have to say, I did a Bachelor of Commerce at the University of New South Wales. If you're going to do business in Sydney, then that and the University of Sydney are kind of the two places you would want to go to. And frankly, my college experience was just okay. There was nothing special. Frankly, I was spending most of my time, doing odd jobs, working, you know, trying to make money and figure out next steps. So it just doesn't have the same kind of cachet as it does here in the US, which is a pity because I think it's a really formative and important part of your life. And probably there should be a little more emphasis on it, but for me that wasn't the case. See, you may ask someone else who has a different opinion, but for the most part that's I think the general consensus.
So how do you go from your time in college, let's say that it was maybe not that eventful for our yeah. but to Glencore, which I believe is one of your first main jobs.
Yeah, so I'll try to give you the 30,000 foot sort of brief summary of my last kind of 20 years of my career. Actually, my very first job was a life insurance advisor. I became a financial planner and insurance advisor, and I got a scholarship with one of the insurance companies in the US, in Australia, I beg your pardon. And I just really did not like the industry. I found that to be successful, particularly in life insurance, you had to kind of sell to someone at the negative end of the spectrum. You know, what happens to you if, you know, your husband dies and God forbid something goes wrong and how, you know, who's going to take care of you? I just didn't particularly enjoy it. And I asked my boss one day, I said, listen, this is not for me. I'd like to leave. I'll give you as long as you need me to stay, but I'd like to leave. I only did that for about a year. And he said, well, look, you know, I appreciate that. I've got a friend who happens to be working for a company called Glencore. It's a private, very successful Swiss commodities trading company. And the guys make a lot of money and it's a fascinating career. And why don't you check it out? And so long story short, I interviewed with those guys. There was something about the mystique of this company that enthralled me a little bit. And so I did a bunch of interviews and I went to Switzerland and I got my first job with those guys in the head office in Switzerland as what they call a traffic analyst, which is basically doing logistics. So I did that for a year. And then my boss called me in one day and said, look, there's an opportunity to move to Jakarta. And I thought he said Chicago, but no, he said Jakarta, Indonesia. And he said, you can go make a name for yourself in the company. And it's a coal, it's part of the coal division and you'd be buying coal from the Indonesian mines and selling it to the rest of the world. And he said, today's Thursday, and I'd like you to be down there by Monday.
What?
I knew nothing about Indonesia. But I was single and didn't really have anything to lose. So I said, what the hell? And so I went down there and it was just a fascinating life experience. I spent the next 8 years there and eventually grew to be the head of the office and the head of the region, and managed eventually a $500 million commodities trading desk. And it was just a wonderful life experience, frankly. We were doing a ton of travel. I mean, I was probably on an airplane, maybe 250 or 300 flights a year. So it was just constantly going to meet miners in the mines. Then, and it was physical trading. This was not commodity. This is not paper trading where you've got 12, people imagine where you've got like 12 screens on your desk and you're trading paper. No, this was physical trading. So you would physically go and meet the miners, go out with them, schmooze, party, have a good time. And then you would get on a plane and then go meet a potential buyer in India or China or Taiwan or Malaysia or, Bangkok or what have you. And so it was a fun experience. The commodity markets were booming while I was there. We also saw the 2008 crash. And so I got to see a lot of boom and bust. I got to see people make stupid amounts of money very quickly and then lose a lot of money very quickly. I got to make some great relationships, work really hard. The one thing I didn't get to have really was to have a really solid, stable relationship. And so that's not a career that is very amenable to like a nice family, stable work-life balance, right? That's hardcore, all in. Your customers are your friends. There's not a lot of vacation time. There's not a lot that goes on outside of that. But for me, it was fine. It was great. I was in my late 20s. I was in my and early 30s, and I was having a great time. But eventually it gets old, and you have enough of living on an airplane or what have you. And I decided in 2016 ultimately to call it quits, and I left Indonesia and essentially moved to New York. And I was in New York, blank canvas, looking for, no job, no career, no girlfriend, just kind of blank canvas. And then I started an e-commerce business, which initially was something I used to get a visa, frankly, because I needed to get a work visa. And so I decided I'll start a company, I'll sponsor myself, get a visa. But it surprised me that the e-commerce business took off, which ultimately turned into a roll-up, where we raised a couple hundred million dollars. And then exited that in 2023. And, we acquired 32 companies and built the team to about 200 people. And we exited that in 2023. So, I'm giving you the 30,000 foot view and happy to dig into.
No, that's great, because actually people that are like entrepreneurs like you, they want to see other people succeed at what happened in their careers. Because sometimes I think the fear that a lot of people have is that, okay, I have my job, let's say your case, commodities trader in Indonesia, and you're like, okay, do I quit this and start a blank canvas, like you said, like completely reinvent yourself in a new city, new town, create a new opportunity. And I think that fear that people have, did you ever fear that you made a mistake when you were in New York?
Look, it's a great question. And one thing I've learned, in life and in business is there's no real black and white to anything, right? There's 50,000 shades of gray. And there's no one way to do things. There's a million ways to do things. I remember before I left, there were several very smart people of mine who were mentors who said, you're crazy. You're one of the world experts in trading coal. Very few people know the market as well as you do. It's very hard for someone who doesn't know the market to get into the market. There's barriers to entry. So, and you're making great money, so you're crazy to leave. And my perspective was, listen, that's a very valid argument. It's a valid argument, but it doesn't feel right to me. I'm still young. At the time I was 33. And you can still have numerous other careers. I mean, if I could have stayed and traded coal and moved to New York and had more of a work-life balance, I probably would have stuck with the industry, but that wasn't available to me. I would have had to stay in, Southeast Asia or go somewhere that I didn't necessarily want to be. So for me, it was a matter of necessity that I had to find something new. And frankly, you know, after doing something for a decade, I thought it would be exciting and a fun challenge to try something new. You know, someone once said to me, if you change your career every 10 years or you do something different every 10 years, you're probably going to have a really exciting and interesting life. And that kind of stuck with me and resonated with me. And I thought, okay, I've been doing this for 10 years. Let me go try the next thing and see how that plays out. And, you know, I had fortunately done, you know, reasonably well for myself. So, you know, it helps when you can try something, and if it doesn't work, you're okay. You know, at that stage, I didn't have a family and kids. So that's the time to try things, right? Is when you're single and you don't have those commitments, you know, you can afford to make a mistake. And so it's much easier to do it in those circumstances.
But then Elevated Brands, I believe, is the last one that you said, like you had all this, I will say a $300 million exit. Is that right? Is that what you referred to? And so what's the genesis of Elevated Brands? How do you, let's say, will envision it? Like, is it something that you picture from the beginning, or is something that kind of like was working itself out?
You know, in my experience, I usually have found, and again, there's many ways to do things. I have usually found the phrase "start where you stand" applies, and then iterate and iterate and iterate until it works. That's been my approach, as opposed to having this grand strategy that I executed perfectly from day one. So that's not how it happened. What I did was I started initially trading footwear on Amazon. So I was buying branded footwear, Adidas and Hoka and Nike and New Balance. I was buying it initially from stores. And then eventually I found some wholesalers and distributors where I would buy it. And then I would put it up and sell it on Amazon. And I did that for a couple of years. And then I always found it interesting, you know, and by the way, I had also started dabbling with private label where you start a brand from scratch and you launch it and you try and sell it on Amazon. And so then I looked at the Amazon ecosystem and, you know, there was like over 100,000 sellers who were making more than $1 million in revenue. And most of those businesses were small brands. Many of them were like small commodity type businesses. But you could buy them for like 2x or 3x EBITDA. And I thought that's very interesting, because what if you could roll them up, package them all together? You know, that would be something that would be an interesting business model. So I always believe in starting and testing small. And if it doesn't work, well, then that's okay. You just move on to the next thing. And if it does work, then you double down and you double down again. So that's how we did it. We bought our first business in 2019. It was $200,000 of revenue. It was tiny. It was just an experiment to kind of dip our toe in the water and see what it's like. And then we made another acquisition early 2020, just before COVID hit. And again, that was like a $400,000 revenue business. So these are tiny acquisitions that we paid maybe 2 or 2.5x earnings. And both of those went well. And then, of course, COVID hit. And that's when I took a step back and I said, okay, wow, this is really interesting now, because in times of distress, that's when you have the biggest opportunity to make something happen. And so when COVID hit, investors became enthralled with e-commerce, and I was introduced to a couple of investors who liked this idea that we were buying small businesses and liked the idea that I had a background in running big businesses already. And could see the track record over the previous couple of years that we were running a frugal, profitable, streamlined business. And so we raised like $8 million early 2020, sort of mid 2020. Then we bought another couple of businesses, and those performed very well because we had massive tailwinds at that time, right? Everything e-commerce was growing gangbusters. So our track record looked really, really strong by the time we got to early 2021. And that's when we raised a very significant amount of equity and debt. And that's when it was balls to the wall, gangbusters. You know, when we started 2021, we had planned to buy maybe 5 businesses. We ended up buying 20.
Wow.
So we, you know, we grew the team from 15 people to 220 in that year. So 2021 was a very frenetic year of activity. And, it was a very, very, you know, cool and interesting experience.
Great, great, excellent teaching. What can you teach to an entrepreneur right now that is trying to get into the e-commerce platforms? Is it too late? Is it what's going to happen with all the tariffs? Do you see new opportunities to now that Donald Trump has placed his tariffs to China and the Chinese competitors are becoming less of a competitor, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's more geopolitical uncertainty, so that's something to factor. The most important thing that I think is to have a product that is that has something of a moat, a competitive advantage. So a moat could be a patent, and you have some patents, so you understand that well. So if a business has a patent, I think that's great. A design patent isn't worth too much. A utility patent is worth a lot. It's harder to get. It's more expensive. But if you have something that's worth protecting, then it's and that can in fact get a utility patent, it's worth doing. Or you might have some kind of supply chain advantage where you're able to source it from somewhere that other people can't easily get access to. See, if you're buying a product that anyone can pick up the phone and source from Alibaba or source from somewhere in China, and it doesn't really have any kind of competitive advantage, it's very hard to be successful. Because especially on a platform like Amazon, there's just thousands of people every day looking for white space. And so if they see a product that's doing really well, very quickly they will launch a similar product, a copycat product that looks very similar to yours. And then over time, your margins get eroded because everyone's competing for the same pie. And if someone looks at your product next to 10 other products, is there a reason why they're going to buy yours versus someone else's? What's the reason? Because on Amazon, for the most part, if you type in, I don't know, beach tent, they almost all look the same. It's very hard to differentiate. And so why is someone going to buy? Why do you deserve to get the customer versus someone else? So if you have a brand where people truly recognize the brand, one of the businesses we acquired in 2020, sorry, 2022, I beg your pardon. We acquired in 2022 is Rhino USA. And at the time, it was doing about $20 million of revenue. And Rhino USA, they sell motorsport accessories. So if you're into motorsports and off-roading, they sell ratchet straps and D-rings and tire inflators and things of that nature. And if you're into that, you probably recognize the brand. Most people would recognize the brand. It's a real brand. Those guys have done tremendous grassroots marketing. They go to all the conferences. They have very strong touch point customer service. It's a real brand that people recognize. And so when that's sitting on the shelf next to other people, people are happy to buy the Rhino USA, even if it's a little more expensive. And that's how you know you have a brand. And that business, 3 years later, as I said, we bought it for about 20, it was doing about 20 million of revenue. This year is going to do well north of 100 million. So, that business has continued to grow and leverage the customer base, their suppliers, and now they've got into brick and mortar and they've really scaled rapidly. So I think that's the key is you've got to have some kind of competitive advantage that sets you apart from everyone else, that you're not just a commodity competing with a thousand other copycats.
Great, great. That's a great advice, especially for all entrepreneurs right now that are trying to get into the e-commerce platforms. And one very important thing that, as you as a successful entrepreneur, can share with our audience is the fact that you had basically not only elevated brands provided you with this catapult, but let's go back to the grassroots when you were coming back to New York first time, and then you were doing the simple. I was arbitrage, sort of buying the shoes somewhere and reselling them somewhere else. Is for those entrepreneurs that are really at the very, very early stages, do you recommend that model? Like, for example, go to Costco, purchase things that are like probably at a discount, put them back into some eBay or Amazon, and start like there, like to get the foot on the ground, get the feet wet, to get to know what really this e-commerce play is about.
Yeah, there's look, not all businesses are created equal, and not all business models are created equal, and so you have to understand the business model you're dealing with. So, a SaaS business model, you're probably not going to make any money. You're going to be burning cash, but then one day you could sell it for a multiple of revenue, and you could make very good money. In the case of doing retail arbitrage, it's almost the exact opposite. It's a nice cash business. So you can get in there and you can make a bit of cash, but you're never going to sell that for a multiple of revenue, right? It's just the resell, the exit potential for a business like that is very low. So you have to kind of pick the model that fits your profile, fits where you are, fits your current liquidity. You've got to pick something that suits you. A business model like that, if you've never run a business, it's not a bad way to get your toe in the door because, let's say you go to Walmart and you buy But let's say you go to a Nike outlet store and you buy a pair of Nike shoes for $50. You can see what price that shoe is selling on Amazon for. Now, let's say you see that that same shoe is selling on Amazon for $100. And then you calculate, and by the way, there are softwares that do this for you. And then you calculate the Amazon fees of 15% and the shipping and all that stuff. And you figure out, okay, well, I could make a $20 profit on a $50 pair of shoes. Not a bad return on investment, right? 40% return on investment, right? Contribution margin before overhead and other expenses. Not bad. So it's a low risk way to get into the game. You could start with $1,000 in your pocket. You can get involved. You can start understanding how business works. You can set up your accounts and just start getting your foot in the game and understanding how to run a small business. And then, you know, over time, I mean, to scale a business like that is relatively challenging. And it's never going to be a very high quality business. But what you can do is you can use those cash flows to then reinvest into other exciting opportunities, which is what we did. You know, Amazon's a classic case where, you know, Bezos was very profitable selling books. And then he used those cash flows to invest into other experiments, which he didn't know if they were going to work. Because if it's an experiment, you don't know if it's going to succeed.
Let's make the Amazon cloud.
Let's make Amazon cloud. Let's do third-party marketplace. Like, let's test, you know, Amazon. And what we see today are experiments that have gone wildly right. But Amazon also had experiments that went wildly wrong, right? I mean, they had the Fire Phone at one stage. And, you know, they blew billions and billions of dollars on that. And so I'm a big believer in starting with something that kind of resonates with you, getting going, you know, hopefully you get some traction and then you double down and then you experiment with other things that eventually can turn.
They have a much higher potential rate of return. Coming back to that part of your investment criteria and just wrapping up your interview, you are an angel investor. Obviously you invest in different ventures. What do you see in the business plan? What do you see? Do you see more of a potential SaaS model? Do you see more something that has the team? Do you see a little bit of both? What is that you like to see, and what are the amount that you usually invest as an angel in startups right now?
Yeah, you know, I am. So, I mean, one of the areas that I've invested in recently is the humanoid robot space. I think that is just fascinating. I think it's going to be one of the biggest. I think it probably will be by far the biggest industry in the world in probably 10 years from now or 15 years from now. So, you know, with something like that, if a business has significant traction, has a very strong team, I mean, these are kind of, I think picking the sector is a really important piece first. And then, you know, it's table stakes stuff. Of course, it has to have a strong team, right? And it helps if you've got some big name investors behind them who have deep pockets, because, you know, inevitably these businesses are going to have challenges along the way. And to the extent that you've got strong investors on your cap table, is going to make a big difference to help you get through some of those tough times and see through to the other side. So, you know, those are, you know, like the macro, obviously they have to look at the macro picture. You got to look at the competitive landscape. I mean, all those things are kind of table stakes. But to me, the sector is what I find interesting.
So robotics right now is one of the techs that you're very interested in, I guess.
I'm very interested in that space.
AI, I guess, I assume all the stuff with AI. So you see, like this, a little people are calling it the AI bubble, because NVIDIA is basically selling the parts to OpenAI. AI is investing that money that from NVIDIA back into parts. So it's like kind of like this money is floating. That's why some people call it the AI bubble, or the AI bubble, just like in the dot-com bubble, like I think you saw that, or the 2008 financial crisis. Do you see AI as a bubble, or is it just something that it has more tangible legs that to sustain the valuation on this venture?
Yeah, so let me think about how to answer this. I think, like, we're definitely in a bubble in the sense that, like, if you look at the PEs, you know, we're at like super high levels relative to historical standards. So, like, we're definitely in bubble territory, right? There's no question. What a bubble requires to burst, let's say, is something to prick it, something to pop it. And what that impetus is, I don't know. Usually it might be an increase in interest rates, but I think that's unlikely in the near future. A wealth tax, for example, could be the thing that pricks the bubble, because people need liquidity and then they have to sell. And so there needs to be some impetus, which I can't see. It may be years before that comes along, but we're certainly in bubble territory. Valuations are clearly high and clearly expensive. But on the other hand, like NVIDIA had their annual shareholders meeting, their earnings report yesterday. And, you know, they showed they had $57 billion in revenue this quarter. And I think next quarter, $67 billion in revenue. So there's more demand than ever for GPUs. They're lengthening their forecast. So I don't know that I would say NVIDIA is a bubble per se. I mean, it's trading at a reasonably high PE, but it seems to be able to continually justify that. And the demand for GPUs and the Blackwell in particular just seems enormous and insatiable. And so it's hard to say. It's hard to say. I mean, the way I treat it at the moment is I'm not going crazy investing. I'm trying to hold some dry powder, but I'm not selling anything either.
Okay.
And so that's how I look at it. And, you know, at some point for sure, there's going to be a correction and hopefully you've got some dry powder to take advantage of that. But look, the market could still go up another 50, 70. I mean, the market can still go up significantly from this point. So it's just very hard to time the market. But it does seem to have a lot of indications of a bubble. And so that's something to watch out for.
Yeah, I think a lot of people agree with your position. I think they see the indicators, but at the same time, we've never seen anything like that. AI that replaces pretty much anything that we had before. It's a gigantic revolution. I don't think the .com was, it was interesting that you have .com domains and you have virtual companies and things like that. But this is something else. I think that we have to see what happens. But again, thank you so much, Ryan, for your time and for sharing with us all your knowledge. And with your permission, we'll share your website here and your links for those entrepreneurs with business plans. They may want to direct them to you. More than happy that to share your email so they can send those opportunities for your review.
Okay, sounds great. Thanks very much.
All right, guys, have a great day. Thank you, Ryan. Have a great day too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.